Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout.com. In January, Spout.com will present Butterknife, a new generation detective series made by a new generation of filmmakers. Find out more at butterknife.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
We're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Maddie Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. This week, out with the old, in with the new, Maddie and I look ahead to 2008 with our top five most anticipated movies of the year.
Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music from Birdie, and a review of the new Jack Nicholson, Morgan Freeman buddy movie, The Bucket List.
But first, Film Spotting goes digging for oil with Paul Thomas Anderson and Daniel Day-Lewis.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've traveled over half our state to be here tonight. I couldn't get away sooner because my new well was coming in at Coyote Hills and I had to see about it. Ladies and gentlemen, if I say I'm an oil man, you will agree. I'm a family man. I run a family business. This is my son and my partner, H.W. Plainview.
You boys are a regular family business.
Now, you have a great chance here.
My son is a healer and a vessel for the Holy Spirit. He has a church.
You will be cast up and thrust back to the perdition.
I'm fixed like no other company in this field.
Paul Thomas Anderson's latest There Will Be Blood, loosely, very loosely based on Upton Sinclair's 1927 novel Oil, follows the ambition and struggle of Daniel Day-Lewis's Daniel Plainview, an oil man who will stop at nothing to make his fortune in turn-of-the-century Northern California. Now, Kempe, you're a big fan of Paul Thomas Anderson's work. Now, never before has one of his films centered around a single character or performance as domineering of the screen as Daniel Day-Lewis is here in this film. And that's saying a lot when you consider the talent Anderson has successfully surrounded himself with in the past. Philip Seymour Hoffman, Tom Cruise, Adam Sandler, Burt Reynolds. Anderson lets Lewis fly pretty much, I think it's safe to say, unrestrained, with the marauding Daniel Plainview, replete with a John Huston snarl and a swagger evoking Orson Welles. Seemingly, Anderson has tied his movie to this performance, right? If we don't buy Plainview, we're not going to buy P.T. Anderson's Snake Oil. Am I correct?
That's where we're going to start. You're going to force me to start with the movie's imperfections, rather than all of the things that blew me away. Is that what you're doing?
I guess so.
Okay, well, I think you're generally right. I'd like to believe that great filmmaking, though, can overcome any single performance. And fortunately here, for at least three-fourths of the movie, it's not an issue. Daniel Day-Lewis, I think, is a force of nature, and I found him incredibly compelling to watch as Daniel Plainview. And after seeing it a second time, I was probably wrong, leaving him off my top five performances of the year. A lot like Bill the Butcher in Gangs of New York, a performance I also love. It's larger than life, and I think Daniel Day-Lewis somehow manages to be larger than life while also imbuing it with some subtlety and some nuance. And I think it's a tribute to both Day-Lewis's performance and to Paul Thomas Anderson as a screenwriter that almost every line that comes out of Plainview's mouth in this film can be interpreted at least two different ways, including the last line of the film, of course. However, I do think that some of the choices he makes at the end of the film do derail the movie a bit.
Let's not talk about the end of the film yet.
I know you don't want to get there, but you started me off with the acting, so we got to kind of go there.
All right. Well, it is a theatrical performance.
Yes.
I'll grant you that. But when you're given the chance to play basically the physical embodiment of Horace Greeley's exhortations, you don't ask, what would Treat Williams do? You ask, you know, what would J.C. do?
Mm-hmm.
What would Jimmy Cagney do? And it's funny because everyone else in this film pretty much gives a standard contemporary filmic performance, and that disparity only further highlights Plainview's largesse. And
mm-hmm.
the scenes that really, really exemplify that for me were the scenes between the men from Standard Oil
mm-hmm.
and Plainview. David Warshawski plays H.L. Tilford
He's
of
great.
Standard Oil, and he is brilliant, and he is the perfect foil for the audience. Plainview is in full histrionic mode going after these men, and Tilford reacts as any of us would. You know, basically, when someone's on the bus and gets up and
That's
starts
it.
Proselytizing and making an uncomfortable scene and won't be placated, here, Tilford, he just gently tries to
mm-hmm.
reason
He's
with
him. He's mostly in shock.
Basically trying not to set him over the edge. And it's a big performance, I'll grant you, but it's also really recognizable, and I think that's what makes it work. I mean, you work in an office. You must know people like this, people that deal in absolutes, that are driven to the nth degree. You usually find them in the sales department, and I think that's what makes it work.
Well, and this film is definitely one about selling and salesmanship. It covers both Daniel Plainview and Eli, the reverend who becomes Plainview's foil. And we'll talk about that, and I think we'll talk about Paul Dano's performance. And I do want to say to everyone listening who hasn't seen the film yet, we are not going to give anything substantial away at all about the ending of this film. We absolutely are coming to this with the perspective you'd want us to have, which is we do not want to spoil anything. That said, you have to at least address it a little bit. And I just think that when you get to the end of the film here, Maddie, I do think that the sheer insanity of the coda of the last 15 or 20 minutes is a lot of fun. And thematically, it's probably totally appropriate and I think even inevitable. But I think it's fitting that Daniel Day-Lewis in that scene is chewing a steak for a good piece of the final scene because apparently he needed it to go with the scenery he was chomping on. There's a moment where he stands up.
How long did you work on that line?
I came up with that earlier today. I guess he just decided it would be fun to act like a horse as he stood up. I don't really know what he was going for. And I'm just telling you that in that scene, I spent a lot more time thinking about which combinations of famous voices I thought Daniel Day-Lewis was conjuring than the themes Paul Thomas Anderson was probably trying to explore, the corrupt, destructive nature of capitalism. And the best one I came up with, you mentioned John Huston. At the end of this film, we basically get Daniel Day-Lewis go into this mode where he is channeling John Huston mixed with a really drunk Sean Connery. And I'm sorry, I found it distracting. I know that everyone out there, every single comment I've read about this performance thinks it's one for the ages and it's amazing. And like I said, for the most part it is. But at the end, I think Paul Thomas Anderson gives him way too much leash and free rein.
Oh, the reins are off. The problem with the third act is that it just shouldn't have happened. It really should not have been slapped onto this film because it just feels like a different film. And I was thinking about it. I would have loved it if he had made this available, say, on the internet. Because the fact of the matter is, when you finish a great book and or, you know, the last frame of a film, and it leaves you wanting to know what would become of these characters? Where are they 20 years down the line? Well, the fact of the matter is, sometimes it's better left to the imagination. I mean, the mere execution of the third act of this film is just really, really sloppy compared to what he's built before it. And that's really what I want to talk about. This film, for me, is kind of a triptych. It's two small films sandwiching this gorgeous, majestic middle. The first 20 minutes of the movie unfold like a silent film. Mm-hmm. They're just breathtaking. It's reminiscent of turn of the last century films from the likes of, you know, John Ford and D.W. Griffiths, told almost completely in silence. And it introduces us to Plainview and the horrific condition under which these men have to toil. And Anderson basically puts on a clinic in character and setting establishment. We're watching before our very eyes Plainview get forged in this cauldron into a capitalist machine of unchecked ambition. Then in the second act, bam, the second he says, I'm an oil man. Mm-hmm. I'm ready. I am ready to be launched. And I'm expecting a typical sort of Hollywood thriller where the humble citizens of Little Boston, California, sitting on top of this ocean of oil versus this win-it-all-cost entrepreneur. Both sides, of course, will become corrupt. Both sides will deteriorate. But that's not what happens. That's not what Anderson does here. Instead, it becomes a sprawling, beautifully crafted portrait of Plainview. The obstacles put in front of him are not fiscal. They're not business-related. He's already proven he can jump over any of those barrels. Instead, the challenges he faces are far more personal. Mm-hmm. And that's the intrigue of this movie, watching a Captain Ahab figure having to deal with intimate tragedies. Does it work? Does it really say much of anything? I don't know. But I love spending that time. And it reminded me of Terrence Malick's Days of Heaven.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's there. I definitely agree with that. Though, this leads me right to the next point I wanted to make, which is there's a really interesting article over on Slate from a couple weeks ago written by a guy named Dennis Lim. And he talks about these wonderkind directors. And he includes in that group Soderbergh, Fincher, Tarantino, Linklater, Haynes, Sofia Coppola, and Alexander Payne. And he says many of them have a specialty, and he singles them out. Fincher, his visual virtuosity. Linklater is a verbal stylist. Payne is good with character. Coppola with moods and music. And he goes through them, and then he says, with Paul Thomas Anderson, all of the above apply. His thing is that he can do it all. And I have to say, after seeing There Will Be Blood for the second time, I can't argue with him. I was already a huge P.T. Anderson fan, but there was a sense about him that he was a whiz kid kind of director. to borrow another phrase from Lim, that he was certainly very stylish and he had some of these signature traits, but at the same time, he was always sort of just paying tribute to masters like Altman or Scorsese.
Oh, he gets accused of being derivative all the time. Well, I don't think that's unfair.
I've always said you can lay Boogie Nights right over the top of Goodfellas, and you've pretty much got the same film right down to the sped-up coke-snorting shots. I mean, seriously, it's there. It's the same template. It's there in many ways, I think. I think that Paul Thomas Anderson was a lot like that sax player who can nail all of John Coltrane's solos right down to the note, but maybe didn't really have his own sound. And then There Will Be Blood comes along, and maybe the highest compliment I can pay to any director is that I thought it was wholly unique. In terms of its formal strategy, it's like Miles Davis with Kind of Blue all of a sudden deciding to drop modal jazz on us. It's familiar, it sounds a bit like bebop, it feels a bit like bebop, but at the same time, it sounds and feels like something totally new and something we've never heard before, and I think this is Anderson's Kind of Blue.
No, I think you're exactly right. It plays by its own rhythm and its own rules, and what I love about it, it's not the kind of film for me that gets me screaming from the theater going, this is the best film of the year, it crosses all the T's and dots all the I's. No, he loves to live in that mess. He loves to have it remorse with cracks. It's really fun to watch.
Yeah, it is really fun, and it's funny.
And you to sink
on...
into that.
Yeah. I agree with you completely. I had a similar experience. And you mentioned Malick, and I'm saying that I think it's wholly unique. And it's funny, we saw this together. It was my second time. And as I'm driving back home, I'm thinking about that thought that I just really can't say I've seen another movie like this in any way. And then I get home, and I check our email, and there's an email from Blake in Boston who said that he had a chance to see it, and he thoroughly enjoyed it, and he described the ending as Kubrickian, and he suspects that Anderson had meticulously studied previous works from Terrence Malick and Sergio Leone. So who knows? Maybe I'm crazy. I will say to Blake and anyone else out there that I did not watch this film and think about Malick the way I did watching Into the Wild or many other films in these past couple of years, and I certainly didn't sit there and think about it as a Sergio Leone knockoff or a John Ford knockoff. Maybe anytime you're
in the West.
Well,
I'm not suggesting knockoff, but, you know, it's not...
You can't help but see certain comparisons, but at the same time, I was really watching it, just being caught up in the visual strategy that Anderson employs here. That opening you touched on, the dialogue-free portion of this film, I described it as muscular during our Top 5 show a few weeks back. It just shows the raw physicality that goes into doing this work. And the way he uses the camera with these unbroken takes to follow characters behind them a lot of times, and they aren't showy. They aren't these big bravura long takes, but they're great. And then he incorporates close-ups into that, and then what he omits from the frame is also what I love. Daniel Day-Lewis telling that community, and we see him tell other communities later, I'm an oil man. We don't get to see who he's talking to for a long time. That happens a lot throughout the film, and it's because it doesn't matter who he's talking to. Every town is the same to Daniel Plainview, and he approaches them all the same way. All that matters is his performance, Daniel Day-Lewis and Plainview performing for the crowd.
He sees his target. He sees who he needs to run over next.
That's it.
And for me, that's probably the only problem with this film is the story. There's no true antagonist for this man. Paul Dano, who plays the young healer prophet of this congregation, there is no way he is going to match Daniel Day-Lewis as Plainview at all. And that's the other problem with the third act is that it's set up that these two opposing forces are going to finally come together and duke it out. Well, he's already won. I've already forgotten about Dano. And he does a really nice job in this role. Yeah, he does a nice job.
He tries to hold his own against Day-Lewis, which I think a lot of actors would struggle with. But I completely agree with you. That was another flaw I had with this film, is that as rivals, they're clearly cut from the same cloth. They're clearly both salesmen here. He's selling religion, Plainview selling you what he can bring you in terms of riches through the oil, and they're both full of self-loathing. And I get that Plainview can recognize the fraudulence in Eli from the start. I just wish I didn't recognize it quite as quickly. And unfortunately,
I
think that Dano here, again, he tries, but I think he's too obviously a phony.
Before you begin, you should introduce me. You'll see me walk up towards the oil well, and when I begin,
Derek.
You'll see me walk up. And then you could say my name.
When you walk up.
Yes, you'll see me walk up, and then you could say, the proud son of these hills who tended his father's flock. And then you could say my name.
He's too much of a huckster right from the beginning. There are scenes where he's trying to sell to the crowd. He's sermonizing in front of the church, and I'm sorry, I didn't think he was that convincing. And
is it a backhanded compliment to say that's kind of why I liked it?
Maybe.
He wasn't that convincing?
Good as a preacher? Maybe, but you know, when it gets over, Plainview mocks him a little and says to him, well, it was one hell of a show. And I was sitting there thinking, well, it was an attempt at one hell of a show, but he didn't really pull it off. And maybe it's a matter of the people in the Church of the Third Revelation. They want to believe so badly that they will buy into even a bad preacher's sermonizing, and it could have been commenting on that in a way. P.T. Anderson could have been, but I really just felt like Dano couldn't pull off the complexity of the character, that inner hatred and self-loathing that Daniel Day-Lewis can. He couldn't make him as interesting.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And it gets back to my original point. This is our spending time with Ahab, basically going after the whale without an Ishmael to guide us. He has his son, H.L., but he's just more of a prop, a very obvious prop.
Yes.
And that's going to come up again at the end. But yeah, the most thought-provoking film, I think, for me for the year.
Yeah, I would agree. It's right up there. And I will also say, just real quick, we've received a lot of emails about this film already, and everyone likes to touch on Citizen Kane. You did it in your setup, and the comparison is an appropriate one. But it's funny, I actually ended up thinking about another Orson Welles film watching this one. No, actually his second film, The Magnificent Ambersons, another film, this sweeping family American film. And it's funny because there is a point in the film, there's a narration at the beginning where someone says, there were people, grown people they were, who expressed themselves longingly. They did hope to live to see the day when that boy, George, one of the characters, would get his comeuppance. And then you hear a wife, a character in the scene, say, his what? And her husband says, his comeuppance. Something's bound to take him down someday. I only want to be there. And maybe there's nothing more American than wanting your fellow man to get his comeuppance. Certainly, you look at Plainview and Eli, this whole film is about those moments where they each get to extract their comeuppance from the other person. So I just thought that was an interesting comparison I couldn't help but think about as I watched the film. But yeah, we haven't even touched on either the Johnny Greenwood score. I loved it. I thought it was amazing.
It's beautiful.
It's really haunting. And there was even a great point in there where at various points he speeds it up and it almost starts to be reminiscent of like one of those 1950s fast pace people in the big city walking, and yet it's this really scary hypnotic thing, but the pace of it, the tempo and the feel of it, you think, wow, I'm watching any 1950s movie about ambitious people. That's what it felt like to me, and it was great.
Now, is Greenwood in Radiohead, or is it his brother in Radiohead?
No, I believe he's from Radiohead.
Okay.
Yeah, so the music is great. The cinematography from Robert Elswit is amazing. There are some shots in here where when Daniel Day-Lewis comes out to speak to a crowd, it's just like those scenes in a musical documentary, a concert movie where, like, Keith Richards and Mick Jagger walk out of the room.
Look at all
the
different movies we're referencing, trying to wrap our heads and trying to describe this thing.
That's right, because I think it is actually, in a way, so unique or unique that you can't help but then try to classify it, and it's very hard to do. But it's an amazing film, and it's out now in limited release. If you've seen it and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463.
Okay, time for a quick break. Up next, a special double entendre edition of Massacre Theater. Really? Is there any other kind? And yet another movie featuring narration by Morgan Freeman. Get busy living or get busy dying. Either way, stay with us.
We left the red boots to wander Catherine Avenue and cracker crumbs beneath the couch. Had a better view, we stumbled and sailed on over brackish water. New roses, they dry inside of a vacant house. We creep quietly by like a Christmas mouse. I remember walks to Elizabeth's or the Parkway Drive. Mother's closet above the splintered floors. The holidays, the dolls you gave, still we went away. Henry, don't you know that you are a friend of mine? Henry, you are a friend of mine.
And that's all I got so far. But I'll give you $20 off my salary every week. I'll give you notes with interest, double, triple, till every cent is paid, I promise.
When you came to me yesterday, I didn't ask if she was guilty. I didn't ask if she was innocent. I didn't ask if she was a drunk or a dope fiend. No. All I said was, do you have $5,000? You said yes, but you don't have $5,000. So I figure you're a dirty liar, and I don't waste my time with dirty liars.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. It's time now for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we act out a scene from a film we love and you, the listener, get a shot at a free DVD. Now, last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard with John C. Reilly and Richard Gere from Chicago, a tie-in, of course, with our discussion of John C. Reilly's turn as Dewey Cox in Walk Hard. And I do have to say, Adam, methinks the film critic doth protest a little bit too much. That was an unprecedented move by you, distancing yourself from the film before we actually did it. You had to say, now, we like this film, but we don't love this film.
Well, it is true. And, Maddie, I was speaking on your behalf because right before we sat down to record the show, I checked our Netflix ratings, and you've only given it 3 stars, saying I liked it. So unless you've changed your mind.
We have never done that. I don't think our doing the scene from a movie is a tacit endorsement of that scene.
It is if we come into the segment by saying from a film we love. So I was just trying to cover our bases there. Though we did get a lot of emails from people. There were actually more than I thought saying I love Chicago, but many more saying completely overrated, never should have won Best Picture. Probably true. Nevertheless, I do think it's a pretty fun film, and it was a fun scene to do, certainly.
Okay, well, Adam, reach into the film spotting hat, and please pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is someone with a film spotting nickname. This is Catherine the Deepest Burn from Greater New Orleans. Congratulations, Catherine. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Now, you guys got to look menacing. Can you be more menacing?
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater. This is going to be a lot of fun. I think it does tie in with a topic we're discussing on this week's show. All we will say for now, it should become fairly obvious as you get through the show. Maddie, you started off, so I'm going to give you the action. And action.
Hello.
Hello. Blank.
Yes.
Well, I was just sitting here realizing that I had never shown you my Renoir.
What are you talking about?
I'm inviting you to come over and look at my Renoir.
You're inviting me to bed.
Yes, it happens to be in my bedroom.
Is the Renoir under the covers?
Don't cackle, Blank. Do you want to see it?
Do I want to come to your bedroom? Let me think.
Do you?
Just give me a minute. Give me a minute. It's a tough one. Yeah, okay, I guess so, sure. Why not?
I'll see you in a bit. If I don't answer the bell, that means the back door is open.
The back door is open.
And scene. All right, if you know what film Maddie and I just massacred, email your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback at filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
My freshman philosophy professor assigned this exercise and called it a bucket list. We were supposed to make a list of all the things we wanted to do in our lives before we kicked the bucket. Cutesy. It's pointless now. We could do this. We should do this.
This is living!
Is he insane?
Depends.
You're gonna drive it or buy it a dress?
Just getting to know each other.
A clip from the trailer there for the new movie, The Bucket List, directed by Rob Reiner. And Maddie, later in the show, we're going to be talking about our top 5 movies this year we're most looking forward to. And there's a lot of reasons, of course, that you can be excited by a movie. The director, the screenwriter, maybe the subject matter really interests you. Or, of course, there's the stars, and The Bucket List is sort of American Gangster for the geriatric set. Instead of legends in training Denzel Washington and Russell Crowe, we get current legends Jack Nicholson and Morgan Freeman playing, well, Jack Nicholson and Morgan Freeman. Nicholson's Edward Cole covers the ABCs of Jack. He's arrogant, brash, and cantankerous, while Freeman's Carter Chambers could be a close relative of Shawshank's Ellis Boyd Redding. He's thoughtful, reserved, introspective, and naturally prone to narration. We're both suckers for buddy movies, Maddie. Did you have any fun watching these two old lions uncover the fundamental truths of life, friendship, and love?
No.
No?
Could we maybe talk a little bit more about There Will Be Blood. I've got a couple things I want to talk about. Kira Hand's performance. No, it's like when your dad, you've done something wrong and you come home and your dad says, I'm not mad at you. I'm just really disappointed. And that stings more than anything. And you're right. These are three people that I really, really respect in Freeman, Nicholson, and Reiner. And the idea is great. I can see the pitch. I mean, it's a buddy movie. We'll get Freeman and Nicholson skydiving. We'll play a little Joe Cocker. It's all right. You know, the people will eat it up, but they forgot the most important element. And that's a script. I mean, this thing is just pure, unadulterated Hollywood dreck. And the guys, I mean, they try their darndest. And unfortunately, Nicholson's new tactic now is basically to play, you said it, the cantankerous, ornery, mean guy. I have never seen a character hold for a laugh in a film, but I swear to God, Nicholson's character says something kind of off-color to either Freeman or poor Sean Hayes, who's completely wasted as an assistant here. And he just pauses, just sort of inexplicably. I mean, it's a ferocious performance, I'll give it that, but it's also just really desperate and bizarre.
Yeah, maybe he was holding for the crew to laugh. Maybe it was one of those moments that wasn't supposed to be in the final film. Who knows? But I will say about Nicholson that I do admire Jack's lack of vanity. He is willing to put himself in really ugly, unflattering positions and to look ugly himself. And I think there's a recklessness and a bravery to Nicholson that he's always had, really, throughout his career, even though here at this point it would be really easy for him to just play it totally safe at this point in his life and in his career. And I respect him for that. I do think he takes some chances, no matter how stilted the performance ultimately is. But what I can't believe about this movie, which maybe I liked a little bit more than you, it's the kind of film that's not an awful time at all. It's just kind of lazy and a lot less enjoyable than it could have been. I agree, disappointing. But how do you make a movie called The Bucket List and you don't even get the conceit of the film right? How do you have this title without taking the time in the script to actually share the formation of the list with the audience, item by item, to cross off each item as they go along with the audience? Give us something a little to invest in. They treat the bucket list like it's almost a secret document. And even at the end, we don't know how many items they got to, how many they didn't. I just don't get the whole point of the film is crossing off this list, and yet they treat it like it's an afterthought.
Well, because it is an afterthought. This script is obviously an afterthought. We're going to go from car racing, and then we're going to go to skydiving, and then we're going to the Taj Mahal. I have never been more underwhelmed by a scene at the Taj Mahal before.
Yeah.
It's absolutely bizarre. And you are right about Nicholson. It's not... If you really want to see him in a great buddy movie, check out The Last Detail with him and Randy Quaid.
Quaid, yeah, classic.
It's a brilliant film from the early 1970s. There, he's having a lot of fun. The most interesting aspect for this film, I guess, if I have to find something, is probably the Morgan Freeman relationship with his wife, Beverly Todd. But again, they're off having all these stupid, inane adventures that aren't affecting anybody, and she's left at home, and they're not giving her enough screen time.
And his excuse or his explanation for why he's off doing this and leaving her at home is totally forced. And speaking of totally forced, the moments where the movie tries to settle down from being this travelogue, this collection of scenes of them jaunting all over the world, and then tries to be philosophical and have these big important discussions, it feels so forced. And then you throw in with that the broad comedy. Reiner goes for jokes here rather than letting the humor come out naturally. I think the scene you mentioned where they race cars, Freeman getting to drive the car he's always longed to drive, they turn that scene into a demolition derby with them running into each other and destroying the cars in the process. And I'm sorry if I'm getting a little too nitpicky here, but I didn't believe for a second that Morgan Freeman, even when letting loose, would damage the cars the way he's doing in those scenes. And then we get the slow motion Dukes of Hazzard shot of the cars flying through the air doing this jump. It's just stupid. You just didn't need to be quite so obvious there with the humor, as if we're supposed to get really excited at an old man driving a car like a stuntman. Isn't that hilarious? No, it's really not.
Another thing I wanted to talk about from There Will Be Blood was the relationship between Daniel Day-Lewis and his brother.
I like where your head's at, Maddie. Yeah. I do. Really, we probably can't stop here. I will say,
stay away.
In praise
really
of the film,
just stay away.
In praise of the film, and I mentioned this to you earlier when we briefly discussed the film, is that when you are watching a movie like The Bucket List and you know the subject matter, two guys who are going to die trying to do some crazy things and cross these things off their list, it's got to deliver at least one moment where it gets a little bit dusty in the theater, whether it's manipulative, whether it's corny. And there are two scenes at the end of this film that
I know where you're going. I know where you're going.
They were very moving.
My answer is going to be, yes, I'm going to agree with you, but the rest of the movie did not let them earn those scenes.
No, you're right. That's why it's manipulative. Nevertheless, I fell for it. And I actually thought in those scenes, they were surprisingly underplayed compared to the rest of the film. So I will give it that little bit of praise, but it is true, this film is not worth checking out. And we do actually want to ask you about your thoughts about Jack Nicholson, the actor. We have our film spotting poll this week. You can vote at filmspotting.net. We're simply saying Jack Nicholson is
an undisputed master of his craft. Great for the types of characters he plays, playing himself over and over, once great, now running on fumes, or unwatchable.
Maddie, where do you go with that answer?
I would have to say, I'd still give it to him, undisputed master of his craft.
Really? Yeah. I'm really surprised there. I probably would have to go with something along the lines of playing himself over and over. That probably
really?
Is the most obvious answer there with Nicholson. I don't know, all of them apply. Is there an all of the above? Because sometimes he's unwatchable too, I will say that. So nevertheless, The Bucket List is in theaters everywhere this weekend. Feel free to send us your thoughts on the film if you get a chance to see it. feedback@filmspotting.net. Tell us what we missed in this grand buddy film.
Time for another quick break. When we return, your feedback on Walk Hard and the most annoying performances of 2007. Stay with us.
I won't wish for kids, 'cause I would break like glass. And I wish shattering to 6,099 shards. But I can find diamonds on a Saturday in a pothole or down the back streets of Los Angeles. And my stomach aches with jokes and jealousy.
Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD coming out this Tuesday, brought to you by TLAvideo.com. We are very excited to have TLA Video on board. Many of our listeners out in the Philly area may be familiar with their stores, and they have a great selection of movies available online. All the movies that we mention here in this segment will actually be on sale at the TLA site, so you can go there directly through the link on filmspotting.net. We encourage you to do that. It is a way for you to support the show and get some great movies at the same time. And I will mention as well, last week, All the President's Men, the two-disc version on sale through our store.
$27.
$13.99. Cheapest anywhere online, so the prices are good. You're going to go buy it right now, aren't you?
Yep.
Okay. So TLA Video, again, we're really happy to have them on board with the show. Should be a great partnership. And again, we encourage you to check out our store on their site by visiting filmspotting.net. This Tuesday on DVD coming out, a movie I am really curious to see is Syndromes in a Century. It's a brand new film. It's a Thai film, Maddie. And actually, one of our friends here on Film Spotting, Scott Tobias, he was not alone among many film critics who had this film on his top 10 movies of the year list. And I am dying to see it because of that. It's from a director. I know his name. I even have it here listed, written down. I'm not even going to attempt to say it, which is unfortunate because he's a very famous Thai director, but we should probably just move on before I do terrible things to it. Also out in the heat of the night, the 40th Anniversary Collector's Edition. Commentary by Norman Jewison, Lee Grant, Rod Steiger, and Haskell Wexler. How did they get all four of those guys in the same room?
I thought Mr. Steiger had passed.
Yes, well, this must be from an older edition of the DVD, I'm guessing. But other new features being added, featurettes and whatnot, a film I do like. They call me
Mr. Tibbs. I love that film.
Yeah, it's really good. Also out, An Affair to Remember, the 50th anniversary edition of that film. Deborah Kerr, Cary Grant, of course, directed by Leo McCarey. She's Gotta Have It, the Spike Lee film, first time released on DVD, and The Ten, this is a film with Paul Rudd from last year, kind of made the festival rounds. We did not see it or discuss it, but a lot of people did say it was pretty funny. Also, When Harry Met Sally, a collector's edition out of that. I feel like there's been 100 editions of When Harry Met Sally, but this has a commentary by Reiner Efron and Billy Crystal and a bunch of deleted scenes. So if you are a fan of that film, maybe worth checking out the collector's edition of When Harry Met Sally.
Time now to thank everyone who found their way over to filmspotting.net this week and gave so generously. We are humbled, of course, by each and every donation that we get. And to show our thanks, we bestow upon you your patented Film Spotting Van Halgren nickname. Here are our donors. Robert, The Color of Coincidence, that's a Silver Club member. Paul, Deaf Ear for Beauty, another Silver Club member. Scott, The Red Iguana, a.k.a. often confused for my brother, a.k.a. Osmob, another Silver Club donor. Thank you so much, Scott, for your continued support. Thomas, Double Over. Tom, Spicy, But Not Too Spicy. Richard, former Underoos model, that's a Silver Club member, Christopher Pleasant but Never Pleased, Josiah Maternity Beard, and Stephen Pass the Nuts. Thank you, all of you.
We do thank everyone, and we have to mention Robert, the Color of Coincidence, where that name comes from. Robert happens to be a guy who met our two listeners from last week, our two donors, Dave and Jonathan Chesney from Belfast, Ireland.
Unbelievable.
Robert Sfila knows them from backpacking through Ireland or Europe. I can't remember. The email isn't in front of me. But just an amazing coincidence. He was listening to our show, heard those two names, and went, hey, I know those guys. I made friends with them as we were backpacking somewhere. So a shout-out to Dave and Jonathan there from Robert. We do love the coincidence spotting.
Film spotting, bringing the whole world together, one listener at a time.
I'm in molten life and harvest in 6 years. Are these time bombs and unlettable fears?
Hi, this is Todd Haynes, the director of I'm Not There, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Hi, Film Spotting guys. This is Jason Eakin from Kansas City. I've been a little disappointed with you guys of late. Didn't care for Juno at all. Didn't love Atonement as much as I really wanted to. And then, it's as though you knew my heart from all the way in Chicago. You could read my mind because you are the only other people I know who were not impressed with Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. I don't know what everybody sees in this movie. You're completely right. The editing technique is kind of outdated, and I love Sidney Lumet just as much as the next guy. Just as much as everybody should, but this is not a masterpiece, and I was completely disappointed in it. And everybody I know is saying, well, you know, you're the only one. You're the only one who doesn't think it's brilliant. Finally, vindication is mine.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam Kempinar and Maddie Robinson. And Maddie, a great voicemail there from Jason in KC with some love. Finally, we vindicated him for not feeling the love for Sidney Lumet's latest film, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. We always appreciate great voicemails like that, and actually we'll get to a few more voicemails here later on in this segment of listener feedback. But first, we did want to share our poll results from last week's poll question. We obviously shared with you this week's question about Jack Nicholson, but we wanted to know your interest level in the movie we reviewed in the first segment, There Will Be Blood. And so we asked you, I most want to see There Will Be Blood because, and here were your choices. I love P.T. Anderson, I love Daniel Day-Lewis, I love critics who love it, I love period pieces about oil and religion, all of the above, or no blood for me, thanks. How did it come out, Maddie?
Well, there are a lot of people excited to see this movie. 89% were in some way excited to see this film. Number one, I love P.T. Anderson at 29%. I love Daniel Day-Lewis right behind at 28%. All of the above there at 19%. No blood for me, thanks, 11%. I love critics who love it. I guess that's you and me, right?
Mm-hmm.
7%. I love period pieces about oil and religion coming in at 6%. I'm trying to think of some other period pieces about oil and religion.
Yeah, I'm not sure there are that many out there, but it was the best I could come up with, Maddie, at the time. So we do appreciate everyone's feedback there in the poll. And actually, I will point out that we did get a lot of comments on the poll saying if there was a choice that was I love P.T. Anderson and Daniel Day-Lewis, and that was the sole reason, that would have been the biggest winner. And there they are right at the top. So clearly a lot of love for both the fine director, P.T. Anderson, and the fine actor, Daniel Day-Lewis. Again, thanks to everyone there. Let's get to some of our feedback on a film we talked about last week. Talk about opposites from There Will Be Blood, Walk Hard, The Dewey Cox Story with John C. Reilly. And Maddie, basically our feedback here is all related to a little fight we had on air last week over what I said was the best scene in the film and a very funny scene, the Beatles spoof from Walk Hard.
And I thought it was the best example of why this film is terrible.
That's exactly right. Good summation. And so we got some feedback on it, and I want to start with my defense here, Maddie, if I can. This is simply from someone signed Van Halgren. Maddie, I was cringing as I was listening to your Walk Hard review. Does my boy Maddie have a deaf ear for comedy? Walk Hard was perfectly imperfect. I agree with both of you that the movie's reliance on jokes for its comedy in lieu of character is its great flaw, but I think Apatow and company understand the danger, and so what they do to compensate for it is to spoof spoofing.
Oh, it all makes sense now.
Yes, and thankfully get some great actors to help them pull it off. The Beatles scene is the very best example. So over the top, it comments on spoofing itself. Hilarious. Schwartzman, I'll admit, was miscast, but Rudd, holy God, he was almost as perfect as Long. I completely agree. And
I'm sorry I missed out on that meta level.
Uh-huh. Well, I do think he makes a really good case there. And he does close out by saying, Maddie, that as far as he can tell, when it comes to movies we've disagreed on, it has been too many since you came aboard here. He says he can only think of two that he's also seen. And he's got my back both times, Eastern Promises and now Walk Hard. He wants to know what's happened to the two of you.
Sometimes I don't know who you are anymore.
Yeah, Sam. There you have it. Well, we did get some feedback on it, and I got a lot of supporters on that Beatles scene, Maddie, from people who've seen the movie. Jeff in San Francisco, Michael Botts in Madison, Stephanie in Jeffersonville, Indiana. You can go all over the place. TJ Wells in Plainfield, a lot of people wrote in and said the Beatles scene was great.
Hey, I got some support here, too. Stephen Alford in Austin, Texas writes, I'm not going to bother seeing this film, no matter what I hear you guys say about it, but I just have to say, the audio clip of the Beatles scene that you played left me wondering what Adam has been smoking. Completely not funny. Tanya Jones from Abbotsford, British Columbia, also has my back. She watched the clip on YouTube. Her only comment, the very pithy, the very enlightened, wow. Did that suck?
There you go. So obviously some disagreement there on that scene from Walk Hard. I think it's funny. You can find a link to it on filmspotting.net if you want to check it out. But let's get on to some more feedback, Maddie, about our 2007 blowout. Last week on the show, we went through a lot of different categories, overrated, underrated to 2007, our final look back at the year. It also included annoying performances and date movies, the best and worst of the year. We got some great feedback on those, and let's get back to a couple more listener voicemails.
Hey, Adam and Maddie, this is Aaron, Appalling Sunrise in Albany. Just got done listening to your 2007 wrap-up, and I wanted to say that I was glad to see The King of Kong at or near the top of both of your lists. Got to say, I just saw that, and I love that documentary, and I was also a little bit disappointed that you didn't get to your top villains. Billy Mitchell definitely would have made my top villain of 2007. He was diabolical. They might as well have played the Imperial March whenever he was on the screen because worse than Darth Vader.
Hey guys, this is Wally from Los Angeles, and I got a little bit of a bone to pick with you. I am a big fan of Transformers and Pirates of the Caribbean 3. I don't understand how you guys cannot find some enjoyment out of these robust, large, huge, dynamic adventures. Yeah, they're loud. Yeah, there's a lot of crazy things flashing in the screen, but that's kind of what makes them fun. You can sit down and totally get lost in a world that is so far beyond anything you see in any other film, at least for this year. I am going huge on the record to say you guys are just being prudes. Yeah, prudes.
Thanks to Wally and Aaron there. Wally wants to know, Maddie, why we couldn't simply have had fun, why we couldn't enjoy the big, loud spectacles that were Pirates and Transformers. Do you have a response?
Well, I didn't see Pirates, but okay. I did see Transformers, and I think I mentioned this a little bit. I loved it as a kid. I actually loved the cartoon movie version, and I felt that this was more cartoonish than that. I felt that I was talked down to just a completely inexplicable experiment by Michael Bay.
Mm-hmm. He has the most bizarre, cheesy sense of humor of anyone I know, with absolutely no sense of irony, and it didn't work for me. But really, to answer what Wally says there, there is a scene in the movie, as I said during our discussion of it, that totally brought me back to being a kid where you get to watch Bumblebee transform. And I was like, wow, that was cool. Mm-hmm. It was one shot, and it was one of those kind of wow moments.
That first transformation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You get to the end of the film. You can't tell which Transformer is beating up which Transformer, and basically it's just Michael Bay destroying skyscrapers. You see a lot of windows being blown out, and you don't really know what's going on. That's not fun for me.
No, and there's some kind of cuneiform block involved.
Sure. Yeah. I don't know what you just said, but it is the AllSpark, Maddie.
That's what it was, the AllSpark.
The AllSpark. So I can't believe you didn't remember that. And a good one there from Aaron, who talked about The King of Kong, a documentary that made my top 10 of the year and was in our top 5 for our favorite docs of the year. And he's absolutely right. I said on the show I wasn't able to get to my top 5 villains, but like him, Billy Mitchell's on my list. I actually had Donald Rumsfeld from No End in Sight as my number 5 villain.
Oh, no.
I got to keep a political theme.
I forgot we're on public radio now.
I had George W. Bush as my number 5 from last year for being a top villain from the Dixie Chicks documentary, so I'm keeping the theme. Donald Rumsfeld is in there. Bruce Greenwood in his dual role antagonizing Bob Dylan and I'm Not There, number 4. Russell Crowe in 310 to Yuma. Tony Leung from Lust Caution is my number 2. And then Billy Mitchell, The King of Kong. I've never wanted to punch anybody more in my life than that guy. So I'm with you, Aaron. He really is diabolical. Let's get to some more blowout feedback, though, from some of our emails. Good one here from Chris Moody.
He says, greetings and happy new year from Tetbury, UK. One of my best discoveries of 2007 was Film Spotting, just after Sundance last year, and alongside Mark Kermode's weekly ranting on the BBC. You're my link to all things film. On a rare trip to the cinema before Christmas, we took my five-year-old daughter to see Enchanted. This was a massively pleasant surprise, especially Amy Adams. I'd never heard of her before, but she carried the film full of wit and charm. I love the references to previous Disney classics. The Central Park sequence is great. And like Little Miss Sunshine, I left the film buzzing, feeling happy, just very glad I'd seen it. Well, Amy Adams is getting a lot of love for this performance, and she's a favorite of this show.
Yeah, she is. She's really good. And Chris did come to Film Spotting in 07, but whenever we reviewed Junebug on this show, I loved her performance, which I do believe was nominated for an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress.
It
she
was
my choice to win it. She's really talented, and I actually do really want to see Enchanted. I have a three-and-a-half-year-old daughter who is totally obsessed with princesses, so we are finally going to go see this film, and we've received many emails from people like Chris saying Enchanted's a really cute movie and work, so I am looking forward to seeing that. We got some annoying performances feedback as well, this from Jim Briggs in Concord, California. John Leguizamo's bizarre performance as Lorenzo Daza in Love in the Time of Cholera is an easy number one for me. And here, I wanted to read this, Maddie, because even though we didn't see this film, I just love Jim's description. He plays Fermina's overbearing father like the dog who eats Elijah Wood in Sin City. I can't believe this is from Ronald Harwood, who also adapted The Diving Bell and The Butterfly. Even Javier Bardem can't save this thing. And then he adds a totally dead-on note about Jonah Hill's annoying performance in Walk Hard. There's no reason for Nate's ghost in Walk Hard to grow up other than to squeeze Jonah Hill into the film. He's absolutely right.
He's absolutely right. And John, it ends when I say it ends. Bissell in Vernon Hills, Illinois. We'll add to that, as far as annoying performances go, how about Rainn Wilson in Juno? Every single line out of his mouth made me cringe. And we've talked about that first 15 minutes of that film.
Yeah.
Please, if you haven't seen Juno yet, stick with it.
Yeah, stick with it.
Until Rainn leaves the scene.
It will pay off. And I do like Rainn Wilson a lot, generally, but something about his performance in this film and the writing, too, we got to give some credit, I suppose, to Diablo Cody. It just doesn't work there in the film. We also got this one from Sam Smith, Sam, who I had a chance to meet in Nashville, and he actually prompted a lot of our categories last year on the show in our 2006 blowout. So I just wanted to read a couple of these real quick. He's got best location, the Han River in The Host, India in the Darjeeling Limited, London in Sweeney Todd, and Fun Zone in The King of Kong. All good choices. Best line in a movie in 2007, I like men now. Ralph Wiggum, The Simpsons Movie. Most cringe-inducing delivery of a line, honest to blog.
Was that Rainn Wilson? Was that Rainn Wilson?
I don't know who said it, but honestly, I think that's just the most cringe-inducing line of the year. I don't know about the delivery of it. Best performance in a bad movie, Cate Blanchett in Elizabeth the Golden Age. Worst performance in a good movie, Chloe Sevigny from Zodiac, a good choice. Most pretentious waitress. Now, Sam, those are fighting words. I hope what you meant to write is most precocious or most precious, not the most pretentious. Most likely to be considered a masterpiece in 30 years. Maddie, you love this, The Lives of Others. And then best ending, the very controversial No Country for Old Men. I don't know if it was the best ending, but I did love the ending. So I'm right there with you, Sam. And as always, thanks to everyone for the great feedback. If you have a comment for us, email feedback@filmspotting.net.
Time for one last quick break. When we come back, the top five movies Adam and I cannot wait to see this year. Where will The Mummy, Tomb of the Dragon Emperor rank on Adam's list? Find out next. Stay with us.
Be careless. Unconcerned, be careless and unconcerned. Enjoy it while you can. Be careful what you learn. Always understand, you only got one turn. Be careless and unconcerned.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Maddie Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar, and we are going to get into our top five most anticipated films of the year. Should be a lot of fun here, Maddie, but first a couple quick notes. We did want to mention that we will be out at the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah, starting next week. I believe our dates are the 17th through the 22nd. Should be a lot of fun. Maddie is ready to party.
We are getting all the party invites. Yeah. I love it. Me and Rosario and Adrian Grenier at the Motorola party.
Yeah,
I cannot wait.
Somehow we will get excluded from those parties. You never know.
Then, bang, we hit the city, baby. Dead on. For little drinks, little nightlife, little dancing.
We will be available to meet up with any Film Spotting listeners out there. Already started to organize this. You can get more information on filmspotting.net in our message boards. Get the details. But basically right now we're planning on getting together around 1:30 for lunch on Saturday the 19th. So if you're interested in meeting us for some reason and other Film Spotting listeners, you can do that Saturday in Park City. Also, Maddie, I did want to throw out there that Movie City News, the website Movie City News, has a chart with 250 critics listed on it. We are among those 250 critics, and it is the grand chart of every film that came out this year, and everybody's ranking where the movie fell on their top 10 list. And I do just think it's interesting to note, I'm not necessarily proud of this, but it's worth pointing out, the top 7 films of the year, here's what this chart has. This is according to all the ratings of those 250 critics. Number 7, Atonement. Number 6, Juno. Number 5, Once. Number 4, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. Number 3, Zodiac. Number 2, There Will Be Blood. And number 1, No Country for Old Men. It may sound familiar, that's my top 7 films of the year. Not in the right order. No Country is the only one that's in the right order. But those were my top 7 films of the year. I didn't realize my tastes were that close to other
critics.
You
are so with the pack.
I'm so mainstream. You were a little more all over the place, Maddie. I give you credit for that. So anyway, check out that chart if you want to see how all the films of the year ranked based on all the critics' lists. You can do that by visiting Movie City News or filmspotting.net. You will find the link. We're ready to count down the films that we cannot wait to see. And we've talked about this before. You're not like myself and a lot of other Film Spotting listeners I know who get excited necessarily by directors. You are interested in projects.
Exactly.
So how did you form your list?
Yeah, I don't hang on directors or even specific actors, but it's projects. Like, imagine hearing Jeff Bridges and the Coen brothers are teaming up to do a Raymond Chandler-type comedy in 1990s Los Angeles. I'll get excited about that.
Right.
Or all I need is Roy Scheider, Shark. I'm pumped. So right now, the combination actually that I'm really looking forward to and didn't make my list because I think it's reportedly in production right now is M-O-N-Y from Spike Lee, featuring two of my favorite actors, Amy Ryan and Bobby Cannavale, who I just absolutely love. It's about a public activist who ends up serving as mayor of New York, but I don't know if it's going to end up coming out in 2008. But my number 5, which I'm pretty sure will come out in 2008, is Burn After Reading from the Coen brothers. I don't know much about it other than it stars both Pitt and Clooney, Tilda Swinton, and John Malkovich. It doesn't have a set release date, but I'd be surprised if the studios don't try to capitalize, of course, on the success of No Country for Old Men in 2007.
Yeah, no, that's a great pick there. And I do tend to go a little bit more by directors, and these are some of the films that didn't make my list, but I am very interested in Jumper from Darren Aronofsky. Doug Liman has a new film coming out. Spike Jonze, Where the Wild Things Are, and Be Kind, Rewind from Michel Gondry, all films and directors I'm interested in. And we are calling this list, of course, the Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull Memorial List. So you will not see Indiana Jones 4 on either of our lists. It's kind of an obvious pick we're really interested in seeing. My number 5, Maddie, I've got cheats all over this top 5 list. I have come up with some interesting combinations here. Number 5 is my franchises. I've got Star Trek and James Bond 22. J.J. Abrams reviving the Star Trek franchise.
Yeah, that Star Trek looks really great.
Yeah, with a prequel. And it should be a lot of fun to see a young James T. Kirk, which still is uncast at this point, I believe. And Abrams made a Mission Impossible film that I actually thought was worth watching. And Eric Bana's in the film, an actor I like a lot. He's going to play the bad guy, apparently. Mark Forster's on board to direct the new James Bond film. He directed Stranger Than Fiction and Stay and Monsters Ball, so it should be interesting to see what he does with a Bond film. Matthew Almerich, who I really loved in The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, he is in this film, I assume, to play the bad guy. And I do really want to know, can they actually make two good Bond films in a row? And where do you go from the first movie with Daniel Craig, where you completely turned the entire franchise on its head? Do you continue in that kind of sacred cow crushing mode, or do you fall into line and start making conventional action movies? I don't know. but I'm curious.
I hope they keep sticking it to the sacred cow.
Yeah, I do too.
All right, my number four is The Day the Earth Stood Still. I think this December release is probably going to prove the most controversial blockbuster of the year, especially to our cinephile audience. It's a remake of the 1951 science fiction classic of the same name. It was officially selected by the United States National Film Board for preservation in the Library of Congress in 1995. Not only is the original film famous for its iconic science fiction imagery, you know, the flying saucer, but more so for its progressive peacenik politics in the midst of the Cold War. At the helm is director Scott Derrickson, best known for The Exorcism of Emily Rose,
yes.
Which gives me pause. But here's the part. Who is going to be playing the lead role of Klaatu, of course, originally played by Michael Rennie? Who's the most divisive actor do you think they could find to play this
answer,
role?
So I'm not going to answer.
It is the Keanu Reeves.
Yeah.
I cannot wait. Secure your bandwidth now because I guarantee the blogs will be a buzzin'.
Yeah, they probably will. A good choice there by you. My number four choice, this is my foreign directors trying something new pairing. My Blueberry Nights from director Wong Kar-wai and The International from Tom Tickfer. Wong Kar-wai making his English language debut. Jude Law is in it, David Strathern, Natalie Portman. I'm not as excited about the fact that Nora Jones is in the lead in, I believe, her first acting performance, and it only got decent reviews coming out of Cannes, but it is Wong Kar-wai. I want to see what he does. Tom Tickfer, I think, had one of the better chapters in Paris, Je T'aime, and he's doing here what seems to be a pretty straightforward espionage movie with Clive Owen as an Interpol agent investigating arms dealing. It's got my favorite actress in it, Naomi Watts. I do love Clive Owen. Armin Mueller-Stahl is also in it. That comes out in August, and My Blueberry Nights comes out limited in February.
All right, look forward to those. Well, my number three from another foreign-born director, Hellboy 2, The Golden Army.
Nice.
Directed by Guillermo del Toro, director, of course, of Pan's Labyrinth. Sequel, obviously, to the first Hellboy, based on the Dark Horse comic character. Hellboy is a demon brought from another dimension by the Nazis, but he gets raised by the Allies, eventually works for a secret crime-fighting squad on behalf of the United States government. I loved the look and the feel of the first Hellboy, the sort of the mix of the action and the humor, but I found the story really, really lacking, and I felt the whole effort was just a little cartoonish, and I'm hoping this go-around, Del Toro is allowed to bring his darker edge. It's slated to open July 11th.
Yeah, that's an interesting choice, and I, too, am curious about the film, even though I did like Hellboy, it sounds like, more than you. My number three is The Curious Case of Benjamin Button from David Fincher. This is the story of a man who starts aging backwards. There's your youth without youth premise that you like so much, Maddie, hopefully with better results here than Francis Ford Coppola. I was already a huge David Fincher fan before Zodiac, and then he went and made his best film, and I think one of the best of the year. And despite having Brad Pitt in the lead role, it has two actresses
what
I love.
What is it with you and
I
Brad Pitt?
I hate Brad Pitt. I'm sorry, I don't like him. He's not good. Cate Blanchett and Tilda Swinton in this film.
I'm sorry, I don't like him. He's just not good.
Fantastic actresses. That was a nice imitation of me. Thank you, Maddie. And one of the actors I suggested a while back who I thought needed a career revival, Elias Koteas, is also in the film. I like him a lot. Of course, Some Kind of Wonderful and Exotica, a good actor. Also, my pairing here, the future David Fincher. I'm making a bold statement here, but someone who has the visionary style who could be the next David Fincher. I am speaking of Brick writer-director Rian Johnson, his new film coming out, The Brothers Bloom. It's a heist movie. His follow-up, obviously, to Brick. Listen to this cast. Mark Ruffalo, Adrian Brody, Rachel Weisz, Rinko Kikuchi from Babel. Should be great. Looking forward to it. Comes out in August. And The Curious Case of Benjamin Button comes out in November.
All right. Well, my number two is Valkyrie.
God promised Abraham that he would not destroy Sodom if he could find just 10 righteous men. I have a feeling that for Germany, it may come down to one.
I am involved in high treason with all means available to me. Can I count you in?
For anything, sir. Anything at all.
Anything is a very dangerous word, Lieutenant.
This film is right up my alley. I love historical dramas, anything to do with World War II. Tom Cruise stars as Colonel von Stauffenberg, a key figure in, of course, the July 20th plot to assassinate Hitler. Listen to this cast. Branagh, Bill Nighy, Terrence Stamp, Carice von Houten, who impressed a lot of people in
Black Book.
And what I'm really excited about, Bryan Singer, director of The Usual Suspects, he's sort of been on a superhero kick lately with a couple of X-Men films, and of course Superman Returns, hoping he can turn it around here, scheduled to run out October 3rd.
Okay, one I am looking forward to as well. Number two, I've got my triumvirate of comic book movies here, Maddie. I've got The Dark Knight, of course, the next installment in the Batman saga, Iron Man, and The Incredible Hulk. Let's start with Iron Man. Robert Downey Jr., an inspired choice to play that hero there. Terrence Howard, Gwyneth Paltrow, Jeff Bridges in that film. I have to admit, I watched the trailer a couple days ago. The trailer is pretty sweet.
Is that Favreau behind that?
Yeah, Jon Favreau, who doesn't excite me too much as a director, but with that cast, I really do want to see it. Then you've got The Incredible Hulk. The Ang Lee version was just terrible, but here Ed Norton's in it, Liv Tyler, Tim Roth, William Hurt, your boy William Hurt, and Tim Blake Nelson. With The Dark Knight, of course, probably the number one film on most people's lists. Our listeners, I'm sure, are very excited about this film, many of them. I'm not sure about Heath Ledger as the Joker. I've never really been on board the Heath Ledger bandwagon, but you add Maggie Gyllenhaal in to replace Katie Holmes, which...
Thank you.
I'm going to use a baseball metaphor here, Maddie, just... for you, and also to annoy our message board's moderator, Alex Nesnick. Doing that is like replacing Javier Vasquez in your rotation with Johan Santana. So I am very excited about that move. I'm a big Christopher Nolan fan. Shot in Chicago, of course. It's Batman. They all come out over the summer. May for Iron Man, June for the Hulk, and July for The Dark Knight.
I knew the mob wouldn't go down without a fight. But this is different. They've crossed the line.
You crossed the line first, sir. You hammered them, and in their desperation, they turned to a man they didn't fully understand. Some men aren't looking for anything logical. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn.
Starting tonight, people will die. I'm a man of my word.
All right, well, my number one, you already mentioned it, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Really?
My favorite author, F. Scott Fitzgerald, of course, a Minnesota boy. I only vaguely remember the story. I think it's from his collected short stories in Tales of the Jazz Age.
Maybe.
I'm not quite sure. But yeah, it opens November 26th. Really looking forward to it.
And you, unlike me, like Brad Pitt.
I do. I think he's a great actor.
Okay, well, that should be an interesting topic someday on the show. We should get into a Brad Pitt marathon, maybe. My number one, you actually took my number one as well. It was your number five. That is Burn After Reading from the Coen brothers. Listen to this premise from IMDb. A disc containing the memoirs of a CIA agent ends up in the hands of two unscrupulous gym employees who attempt to sell it. That has the Coen brothers written all over it, of course. George Clooney there, Tilda Swinton reteaming with him from Michael Clayton, John Malkovich, Francis McDormand, Richard Jenkins, a great that guy we both like. Unfortunately, yes, Brad Pitt's in it, but it's the Coens, bottom line. I am dying to see any movie they turn out that isn't called The Lady Killers. And also an interesting note I found on IMDb, it's the first Coen Brothers film since Miller's Crossing. They're not going to use Roger Deakins as a cinematographer, which I would say after seeing No Country for Old Men and all their other films, that's a bad idea, except they're replacing him on this film with Emmanuel Lubezki, who shot Children of Men, another brilliant cinematographer. So I don't think they can really misstep there. Burn After Reading, my quick tie with it. They're both comedies. Zach and Mimi Make a Porno. Kevin Smith with Seth Rogen, Elizabeth Banks. Both were in The 40-Year-Old Virgin. Jason Mewes is in it. I think the Apatow-Smith connection here seems like it was made in heaven. And after Clerks 2, which we both liked.
Loved Clerks 2.
I think Kevin Smith definitely has some more credibility, and I think it sounds hilarious. Two platonic friends set out to make an adult film together to try to make some money, and of course things get a little more complicated than that. Both come out in late 08.
Those are our top five most anticipated movies of 2008. Please send your lists or any other feedback about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Opening wide this weekend, the Ice Cube crime comedy First Sunday, In the Name of the King with Jason Statham and Ray Liotta.
Karen.
And the Pirates Who Don't Do Anything, the VeggieTales movie, Karen, which I will be seeing this weekend with my kids.
Is
Can't wait
Veggie
to see
Tales?
It.
Is that the one where, like, Jesus is a cucumber?
No, Jesus is prominently featured in the VeggieTales movies, but I don't believe he's the cucumber. But I will be seeing it and expanding to more screens this weekend, The Bucket List, which we say
avoid
to
avoid at all costs.
And and The Orphanage, which we reviewed on last week's show, a very scary, well-made Spanish movie from a first-time director. We do say check that film out.
On next week's show, we'll review the J.J. Abrams disaster movie Cloverfield, hopefully have an interview with one of Cloverfield's stars, and preview our upcoming trip to Park City, Utah, with our top five most anticipated Sundance movies.
Thanks to our listener volunteers, Alex, Angela, Frank, and Candace. Special thanks to Joe Dassault, Ron Jones, and Tori Malatia at Chicago Public Radio, and to Birdie and Everloving Records for this week's music. Learn more at everloving.com. Really glad to have them on board and some new music from them. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Matty Robinson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout. Visit filmspotting.spout.com to discuss this episode. Should we leave that Karen stuff in there?
No. Or just to anticipate me saying it.
You should do it. Should do it again. Okay. Opening wide this weekend, the Ice Cube.
But then you have to do Karen after the VeggieTales movie.
Great. Okay. I don't know if I could recreate that. Let's try that again. Opening wide this weekend, the Ice Cube crime comedy First Sunday, In the Name of the King with... Karen, I said.
Karen.
What was I supposed to do? They were all over the house.
Karen, that was worth $60,000. I need that money. That's all we got.
What was I supposed to do? They
Karen!
They were in everything.
That's all the money that we had, Karen. I was dependent on that.